It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. From politics to the pandemic to the devastating derecho, it was all part of 2020. This half hour, a few IPR reporters reflect on this incredible news year that's about to come to an end. I check in with several of my colleagues about the top stories they've covered from the past year and how this year has posed some unique challenges to their work of reporting. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Kate Payne in eastern Iowa, from Grant Gerlach in central Iowa, and from Cassidy Arena, who covers Iowa's Latino community. But first, let's start with the overarching news story of the year, of course, the pandemic, with IPR's health reporter, Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
Well, the year's coming to an end, and you've been so busy covering all these facets of the pandemic in the state since it first got real for us back in the spring. When you reflect on 2020, what are the stories you covered that stand out?
Yeah, so you're right, Ben. There's so much has happened with the pandemic this year. I mean, that really is the big health story. Within that, what's really been a big story is sort of how the government, our state government here in Iowa, has been providing, kind of transmitting information to the public. There's been a lot of questions over, you know, where they're getting data, how they're kind of transmitting data to the public. And, you know, back in August, this nurse practitioner spotted on the state's public website that the state was backdating thousands of tests accidentally. And so that was messing up, you know, COVID-19 numbers. Tests that look like they were positive in July were actually from, you know, back in April and March. And the most surprising thing was at a governor's press conference, state medical director Caitlin Padotti admitted that she knew for weeks that this information had been, you know, backdated by an old tech system, and they hadn't bothered to announce it for a couple weeks. And so this was sort of, you know, quite shocking to hear that this was happening.
Mm-hmm. And as you also pointed out, this is important data because it's what was used at a county level positivity rates, for example, to make decisions about schools reopening.
Right. And this was at a period right in the middle of when the Reynolds administration had, you know, announced that schools needed to have a certain positivity rate in order to seek a waiver to go online. This was controversial with some districts like Iowa City and Des Moines were really resistant to this and really wanted to be virtual. And so, yeah, this was data that the school districts had to use in order to apply for this data. Or for this waiver, excuse me. And it turns out some of it was wrong, just incorrect.
Right. And in your reporting, in connection with this, you also got in touch and talked with people who, because of their distrust of the data from the state, crunched their own numbers.
Yeah, that's sort of, you know, this kind of side effect of all of this is you've sort of got this group of, you know, medical professionals, epidemiologists, and even just some, you know, independent sort of data nerds out there that are crunching numbers. And, you know, they're regularly downloading the data that the state provides twice a day. And, you know, Sarah Willett, she's a woman in Ames. She's made an entire website basically breaking it down by county. And she does this for hours every day. She kind of crunches her own numbers based on the state's numbers and is sort of, you know, they've created this check on the state's data just to double check their numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we look back over the, what is it, 9, maybe going on 10 months since we've been dealing with the pandemic here in the Midwest, I mean, we have to think we had, you know, sort of waves of this, but that what happened in November was truly remarkable, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that was, you know, the other big thing was in November, we saw this huge spike in cases. You know, back in the summer, we were reporting, you know, hundreds of new cases a day. And then all of a sudden this fall, that spiked into the thousands. And there was even a day in November, we passed, you know, 5,000 new cases were announced in one 24-hour period, which is, you know, which would have been unheard of if you told me that back in the summer. We saw hospitalizations go through the roof, and we still haven't seen that entirely recover. You know, there's still hospitalization rates are still higher currently than they were back in the fall.
Okay. Natalie Krebs, we wish you well the last couple days of 2020, and let's hope that 2021 is much less on the calamitous health scale that we've been having this year. Natalie, it's been a really real challenge for you, too. We've all migrated, many of us migrating to our homes to report, and you are at home right now talking to me as well, aren't you?
Yes, I am. We've been home at Iowa Public Radio since March, definitely. Definitely still perfecting my home office here.
All right. Natalie Krebs, we look forward to talking to you in 2021. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, checking in with several of our IPR reporters, asking them to reflect on some of their reporting that stands out in their minds during this eventful news year, 2020. Kate Payne is with us now, IPR Eastern Iowa reporter. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Of course, you covered many stories over the many months having to do with the pandemic, but I want to ask you to reflect on stories you did covering the two other huge news events of 2020, our political year, starting off with the Iowa caucuses, which, of course, seems like years ago, doesn't it? And
yes.
this freak, devastating straight-line windstorm that barreled across the state out of nowhere August 10th with the force of a hurricane. Let's talk about that first. What will you remember most in your work reporting on that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, just the devastation, the sheer scale of it was just so difficult to comprehend because the storm came out of nowhere. You know, certainly meteorologists had an indication early on, you know, to get a sense of a little bit of what we were in for. But for so many people, you were lucky if you knew that there was a rainstorm coming that day, and hopefully you heard the storm sirens. But just the extent that this, you know, seeing Century Farms just leveled and people's homes destroyed and people living inside these devastated buildings for days, weeks, and months. And I think that's what part of the story that's really sticking with me is just how this devastation continues even today. The destruction was so severe to so many people's homes. You know, some folks were able to sort of make it work for months, but now with winter here, we're seeing more and more people becoming really homeless and really having to leave some of their homes for the first time and doubling up with other families, staying in shelters or in cars. So this is really a storm that's still impacting the area today.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the political scene. Of course, Caucus Land, you co-hosted and helped produce that wonderful podcast early on. Seems, again, I have to say, like years ago. So what will you remember about caucus? Caucus night, of course, you and I and other IPR reporters mm-hmm. were expecting report results caucus night to call winners and losers, provide analysis, reporting. Instead, there was the waiting and the waiting and the and the waiting. Yeah. That was crazy.
Yeah. And that just for those of us who were, you know, there watching the caucuses from the very beginning, you know, Iowans were going to all of these events a year ahead of time, seeing these candidates, you know, to put in all that work, all that money, time and effort to then on caucus night be primed to expect these results and then not get them was, I mean, I just remember the feeling of just like my stomach, you know, dropping because of all of the effort put into this pivotal moment in American political history for it not to go as planned was really devastating for the Democratic Party and for caucus goers. And folks may have forgotten, may have blocked out that even the Associated Press never actually called the winner for the Iowa caucuses because of the errors and the inconsistencies in the results in certain precincts. The AP couldn't be sure that the results were fully accurate. So it's just a really large shadow cast over the whole caucus experience. And then now, today, you know, Joe Biden is going to be the next president of the United States, someone who fared quite poorly in every caucus cycle that he ran in. So these questions of, is the caucus cycle producing an ultimately successful candidate, the candidate to represent the Democratic Party most fully, you know, in the best sense, mm-hmm. those questions are very much still there.
In the White House, there is, I mean, Joe Biden, you know, for understandable reasons, doesn't have to be a fan of the Iowa caucuses. When will we know the fate of the Iowa caucuses for 2024? Do you know?
I'm really not sure. It's still a major outstanding question. Certainly national Democrats are not a fan of the caucuses and were hopeful that this past one would be the last one. But it's my understanding, you know, because this process is still outlined in state law for both parties, there's some real questions, both at the national political level, but within the Iowa State Legislature, of if real structural changes were to happen, we would need to see legislative changes as well.
Okay, Kate Payne, that's all the time we have for at this time. We could talk a long time, but we'll move on to our next reporter, Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter. Thanks, Kate, for your reflections on 2020.
Thank you.
If you just tuned in, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, quick conversations with several IPR reporters about their stories from 2020. IPR's Grant Gerlach, our Central Iowa reporter, has been covering, among many other news items, he's been keeping us abreast of how Iowa schools have been coping with this pandemic. Grant Gerlach, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
When you think about the way in which this pandemic has transformed education, and it really has, what stands out for you?
Well, it's going online. It's something that some schools had dabbled in. There were a couple districts in the state that had developed some online curriculum, but never to this extent. You know, some schools had given computers or tablets to their students, but never to be used this way. So to go fully online in many districts or partially online in many more was a step that districts never expected to take and didn't really want to take, but the pandemic forced them to.
Yeah, right. And of course, when we think back of on how this pandemic started, first entered our lives and got real in mid-March, right around the time mm-hmm. of spring break for many school districts. And so it was sort of, what do we do, you know, for the rest of the spring semester until the summer break? And then we had this period, which you covered with a lot of reporting through the summer, contemplating how we, and it gained this phrase, return to learn. What stands out for you about that time?
A confusion about what was going to be required and how much freedom schools would have to decide what school would look like for them. It was in July that we had the governor come out with requirements for at least 50% in-person learning, and then the guidelines to determine when schools could go online, depending on pandemic conditions. In August, as the first day of school was coming up, we had schools deciding, well, were they going to go with what the governor was asking, or were they going to go their own way? And then just the whole, all the nuts and bolts of how it actually works to have students learning remotely and to make the technology work, to get the teachers up to speed. There were a lot of moving parts in those early days.
Yeah, there was really a clash, a face-off between these local school districts and many of the bigger ones and the governor.
Yeah, at one point we had three lawsuits. Ames had a lawsuit against the Department of Education. Iowa City had a lawsuit with the State Education Association. Des Moines Public Schools had a lawsuit against the state as well. The Ames lawsuit has been withdrawn. The Iowa City State Education lawsuit has been withdrawn. And the Des Moines Public Schools lawsuit has been cut down to just a much smaller issue than it was before. So what you see overall is, for the most part, schools have worked toward at least getting to the governor's 50% requirement, that has been effective at achieving her goal of getting more students in class, in person, more of the time, except for a period in November when the virus really surged again. And the guideline that we had, that counties had to be at 15% or more transmission rate over a two-week period, that when that number was first set as the guideline, we didn't really expect many counties to ever hit that. But at one point, nearly the whole state was at that number.
It was and, like 97 of 99 counties, or perhaps there was a day when all of them, I don't know.
And so we had more than 50 districts that at least had a building all online during that period. And it's since then, it's obviously schools are on winter break now. And I think only one district has an active waiver with the state at this point.
Yeah. Okay. Perhaps, Grant, more on a personal level, what's it been like for you, not only as someone reporting in depth on education amidst this pandemic for IPR, but also as a parent with kids in a public school system?
There have been a lot of ups and downs, Ben. Like the day that some hot chocolate got spilled on the laptop. That was interesting. but it's still working. I think for the most part, we've been hanging in there and just trying to do the best we can. We're fortunate to, my wife and I both, to be able to work from home and keep an eye on our kids as they're going through this. And as we're going through this, a lot of families don't have that luxury. And that's something I'm very much aware of. But just, it's a lot of skills that probably I didn't figure out until high school or college about working independently and organizing your time. A lot of skills that may come later in life for a lot of kids, but they've had to develop some of that early on.
Yeah, it's amazing when you watch kids deal with the technology and the conditions that we have. It's really amazing. And we hope it doesn't last too much longer and the kids and the teachers and the staff can all get together again the way school, I think we all think should be. You know?
Yeah, I think everyone's eager for that to happen.
Yeah. Okay, Grant Gerlach, we'll look for your reporting in 2021, but thanks now for your reflections on 2020.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, our final check in with several reporters in this look back at some of the more significant stories they've covered. Let's chat with IPR's Cassidy Arena. Hi, Cassidy.
Hi, Ben. Good to speak with you again.
Good to speak with you. You've covered many areas of, let's just say, traditional news, spot news, in addition to being IPR's first reporter dedicated to covering Iowa's Latino community. Let me start off by saying your reporting has really opened my eyes to the struggles and the joys of our Latino neighbors, residents in this state. Let me just say that, and then I'll ask you, what stands out for you when you look back over the news year 2020?
Well, my news year was a little bit less conventional than many others. I moved to Iowa in the middle of the pandemic, so I was resorting to just calling the people that I was going to be covering for my beat. So they had no idea who I was, yet I'm calling them and telling them, hey, share your life stories with me and trust me with your story so that I can share with Iowa.
Yep.
So... Yeah, so my perceptions of all of my coverage has been exactly representative. Just like you said, there are highs and lows with the Latino community, just like others.
Right, and one of the stories you focused on was something that, you know, non-Spanish speakers or people who have lived here, grown up here, don't always think about: the English-only law and how that can complicate life. Well, what did you find most interesting about that reporting?
Oh, gosh. Well, just to begin, the way that I found that story was just like I was talking about. I was just calling people who lived here in Iowa saying, what are some things that are important to you? And that's how I figured out there was an English-only law, or a law that was stipulating that government documents need to be in English and not translated. So at first I was like, what am I going to do with this story? It doesn't really have any relevance right now. But then voting came along, and that's when I really saw it, that it had an effect on how Iowans are voting.
Mm-hmm. You also, to go to the joys of this year in the Latino community, looked at how some really cool Latino traditions carried on through this pandemic, right?
Yes, yes. So that led to, like you said, one of the positive stories. And I'm totally biased, but this was really fun for me to do. I followed a young girl named Carmen and walked around with her for her quinceañera, which was just really fun. I kind of got to, you know, live in her shoes a little bit as I watched her take her photos and her big dress and speak to her family. And it really was, like you said, one of the positives, heartwarming stories.
Yeah, and a quinceañera is when teens sort of come, it's a coming of age celebration for any teen.
Right. Well, it's basically a sweet 16, but when you're 15, and it's primarily for young women.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, we talked on this program, and it was really so touching to talk about Dia de los Muertos, this Mexican holiday in which family members who have died are remembered. That's such an important part of the Latino community and the culture.
Yeah, and just to make things balanced, that was the story that kind of met the positive side of culture and the sad side of what's been going on this year with the pandemic. So it was really a great opportunity to meld basically all that 2020 has brought us into one story of, yes, COVID-19 has cost many people their lives and family members and loved ones. But on the other side of things, this great cultural holiday celebrates those lives and really remembers them and keeps them in their hearts.
Right. And not just during a pandemic, anytime you might have what in your house or a table or something with candles, where you take this day to remember those who have passed in your family, right?
Exactly. And that was one of the most humbling parts. A woman, Veronica Guevara, actually allowed me into her home, and she introduced me and gave me a little mini tour of her altar, which was in remembrance of her grandfather who she lost to COVID-19.
Cassidy, you have not only weathered this strange year, unlike any other, like the rest of us, but as you mentioned, you've coped with it as a newcomer, being parachuted, so to speak, right into our state in the middle of a pandemic. Congratulations. And I can't say enough about all the really spectacular reporting you've done over part of the part of 2020 that you were in Iowa. And we look forward to your reporting in the next year, 2021.
Thank you, Ben. I also look forward to it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
And after a short break, we'll come back and listen to one of our favorite interviews from the archives of 2019. It's a creature that's killed nearly half of all human beings who have ever lived. Last year, I spoke with historian Tim Weingart about his book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. That's coming up after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.